The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon, folks. Great to see you. If you're a follower of Jesus, you'll know we're a slow-moving target in terms of people making fun of us. One of my favourite writers and someone who doesn't just make fun of Christians, he makes fun of everybody, which I figure is okay. P.J. O'Rourke, the American satirist, journalist, says, making fun of born-again Christians is like hunting dairy cows with a high-powered rifle and scope. And I think pretty much he's right. Okay, so he does it with good fun. But I tell you what's interesting, there are other high-profile people that take a real personal, it feels like a real personal dislike to the God of the Bible. And there's a whole different kind of level of, it's not just making fun, it's really quite personal. One of the, if you like, most outspoken critics was Christopher Hitchens. Just have a listen to what he's got to say. This is actually in a debate with his brother Peter, who's a Christian. I'll just get a feel of this.
And I'm actually strongly tempted to. I could leave it right there. But then it's not in my nature to let off a captive audience so easily. So I'll add a couple of things. The reasons why I am glad this is not true would, I suppose, be the gravamen of my case. Some people I know who are atheists will say they wish they could believe it. Some people I know who are former believers say they wish they could have their old faith back. They miss it. I don't understand this at all. I think it's an excellent thing that there's no reason to believe in the absurd propositions I just admittedly rather briefly rehearsed to you. The main reason for this, I think, is that it is a totalitarian belief. It is the wish to be a slave. It is the desire that there be an unalterable, unchallengeable, tyrannical authority who can convict you of thought crime while you are asleep, who can subject you, who must indeed subject you, to a total surveillance around the clock, every waking and sleeping minute of your life, I say of your life, before you're born, and even worse, where the real fun begins, after you're dead. A celestial North Korea.
A very articulate critic of Christianity, particularly the God of the Bible, Christopher Hitchens. Or Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry calls God an evil, capricious, monstrous maniac and is outspoken about it. Richard Dawkins' famous quote, well, it's become quite famous, from the God delusion. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous, proud of it, a petty, unjust, forgiving, control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Now, that is a paragraph. From the God delusion. And of course, not quite in the same league as Peter Fitzsimons, who's happy to put the boot into God and Christians and whenever he possibly can. Now, there may be others too that you've known who will do that, who just haven't got the platform, who aren't quite so famous, people who will mock or oppose the idea of God. You may even be related to some of them, etc. Well, the story of Daniel chapter 5 and the writing on the wall has something to say about this. And it's not an easy chapter. It's quite confronting. So let's have a look at it. We'll see what you think. To put you into context, if you haven't been here the last few weeks, in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, who was in the process of becoming the emperor of the Babylonian Empire, conquered Jerusalem. He took... the Babylonians conquered three times over about 15 years, took the cream of the crop, the young and the beautiful, took them to Babylon, and Daniel and his three friends are caught up in that movement. And Daniel chapter 1, this is significant, Daniel chapter 1 begins and tells us this: in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Along with, notice, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. So a whole lot of the kind of goblets, etc. There were goblets and wine cups that were used in the sacrificial system of Israel. And Nebuchadnezzar took a whole lot of that stuff, put it there, and basically it sat there for 60-odd years untouched. Now, let me just show you how does this work. So Daniel and his friends are taken to Babylon. They end up working in the king's service, the Babylonian royal court. 605, Jerusalem's invaded by Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel and, I couldn't type out of all of Shadrach, S-M-N-A, okay, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel, they're deported to Babylon. They end up in the king's service. 562, Nebuchadnezzar dies after being king of Babylon for 43 years. Last week we talked about Nebuchadnezzar and him losing his mind and being humbled, etc. That's in chapter 4. We're now in 539 BC, and we know the precise date when chapter 5 happens, and I'll tell you why in just a moment. Belshazzar is the king. Well, really, he's the regent, and he's reigning for his father, Nabonidus, who was out fighting wars, etc., and was absent for most of his 17-year reign. Belshazzar was likely to have been regent for around 10 years. Daniel's now an old man. He's been in public service for the king's service for 66 years, something like that. And so we come to the beginning of chapter 5. Let me read it for you quickly. It's in your hand. Daniel chapter 5, verse 1. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. Now, he's in the palace in Babylon. Joyce Baldwin, in her excellent little commentary on Daniel, says this: excavation of the palace in Babylon has uncovered a large room, 51 metres by 17 metres, which has become known as the throne room. One wall was adorned with blue enamel bricks, the other three walls covered with white plaster. So he had a big room and had 1,000 of his cronies over. Now what happened? See verse 2. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine... No, sorry. Where am I now? Ah, yes. There's a remarkable thing about this particular banquet and why it happened, and why we know when it happened. Alan Harmon, in his commentary on Daniel, tells us this: the most remarkable feature of the feast is not the number of those present, 1,000, okay, but the occasion. Just days previously, the Babylonians had suffered a great defeat at the hand of the Persians at Sippar, about 80 kilometres north of Babylon. And Nabonidus, that's Belshazzar's dad, had fled. Now the Persians are at the gates of Babylon, and that very night Belshazzar will die. So you've got the Persians outside, the armies in siege, besieging Babylon, and Belshazzar says, let's have a massive party and get drunk, etc., with 1,000 of his cronies. Now what happens? Verse 2. Also, that's how we know it's 539. In 539, the Persians took Babylon. When Belshazzar was drinking his wine, verse 2, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. 66 years they have sat untouched from when Nebuchadnezzar brought them back. And if you're a Bible reader, you'd be thinking, oh no, don't do it, don't. But he does it. Verse 3. So they brought in the gold goblets and had them taken, that he had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. And as they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, of iron, wood and stone. Now, it's not the things themselves. It's not the gold goblets or what. That's superstition. It's not that they have power or whatever. It's what it stands for. So if someone burns a flag, you burn the Australian flag, or in the USA you burn the United States flag, it's just a piece of cloth. Why do people get so upset about it? It's because of what it stands for. Or if someone defaces a picture of your mum, well, it's just a little piece of photographic paper. No, it's not. It's a picture of your mum. And here's what does this stand for? Well, he is deliberately mocking the God of Israel, the God of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. I don't know whether it's bravado, you know, let's eat and drink for tomorrow we die, or it's deliberately rejecting what Nebuchadnezzar had learned in chapter 4, but this is flipping the middle finger to the God of Israel, deliberately, and deliberately says about praising the idols, etc. Okay, that's what it stands for. This it could not be more insulting or confronting to the God of the Bible. And so verse 5, suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. It might be a euphemism there. Literally says the joints of his loins were loosened. He may have just lost control of a few things, if you know what I mean. Anyway, right. So what do we have? Verse 7. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, diviners, and then said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Notice the third highest. Why? Because Belshazzar himself is the regent. Okay. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became more terrified and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. Verse 10. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. May the king live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. Now, if you read carefully, it's not Belshazzar's wife. In verse 3, she's already in the party drinking. It's probably the queen mother or even potentially the queen grandmother. Why? Because she remembers Nebuchadnezzar's reign, which finished 23 years earlier. And what does she say? Verse 11, there is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight, intelligence, and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. And she says this man could understand what the writing on the wall means. And so verse 13, so Daniel was brought in before the king. And the king said to him, are you Daniel, one of the exiles, my father the king, brought from Judah? By the way, father doesn't mean just one generation. It can mean multiple. Okay, and the Bible has a more broad way in which the word father is used. The king says, I'm told that you can interpret. And the king offers him all of the gold chain and the third ruler of the kingdom and clothed in purple. And verse 17, you can tell Daniel's an old man. He doesn't care anymore. He doesn't care. Verse 17. And Daniel answered the king, you may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. But Daniel wants to explain it in context. See verse 18. Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. Those he wanted to humble, he humbled. Notice verse 20. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like an ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven. As we saw last week, Nebuchadnezzar lost his mind, and we talked about lycanthropy and boanthropy, the mental illness potentially that it was. And notice verse 21 in the middle. Until when? Until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all the kingdoms of the earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. But, verse 22, you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you've set yourself up against the Lord of heaven, and you had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, your concubines drank wine from them, and you praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze of iron, wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand, but you did not honour the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written. And I'm not sure how to pronounce it exactly, but Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parson. And when you read what the scholars say, those are just ordinary Aramaic words. Aramaic was the language of Persia, etc., and a popular language in the Middle East. They're just ordinary Aramaic words about measures and weights. And they can mean a particular weight or they can mean the activity. So basically the words just mean numbered, weighed, divided. Numbered, weighed, divided. So when the wise men and all the astrologers come in, the problem is not reading the words. The problem is working out what are four words on the wall mean. Okay. So Daniel explains it. Verse 26. Here is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the scales and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple. A gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed third highest ruler in the kingdom. And note verse 30. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. There's some debate of whether or not Darius the Mede is actually the same person as Cyrus, or ruled as a regent for Cyrus later. There's debate about that. Now, how did that happen, though, that very night? I've been talking about how big the walls of Babylon were and how strong the city was. Alan Harmon explains in the commentary on Daniel. Extra accounts such as those by the Greek historians Herodotus and Xenophon give more details of the event. The river Euphrates flowed under parts of Babylon, and the Medo-Persian troops were able to divert its waters and subsequently to enter the city through the tunnels underneath it. Two cuneiform documents, the Nabonidus Chronicle and the Cyrus Cylinder, both had reference to the downfall of Babylon. So that's why the city fell that night. The question as you read it, if you've been coming along, if you've read the book of Daniel, if you've done that, read those first chapters, Nebuchadnezzar seems to get lots and lots of chances. So, you know, chapter 2, he gets a chance to humble himself before God. Chapter 3, he gets the chance. Chapter 4, he gets the chance, finally gets the message. Belshazzar, one thing, bang, he's gone. Why is God harsher on him? Okay, there you go. It's not a rhetorical question. I say, who needs rhetorical questions? Any thoughts?
Verse 22, you knew all this.
Don't you hate it when someone nails it absolutely straight away? That's right, exactly. Is it verse? Yeah, you nailed it. Verse 22, yeah, exactly. Daniel says to him, you knew all of this. He says, but you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Or verse 23, you did not honour the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. So what do we take away from this chapter? Well, there's a theme that runs through the Bible, and there's this, that God is judge, and God will judge us and hold us responsible for our actions, and particularly for how we've responded to him, the one who holds our life and everything else, the one who gives us life. But also, the more you know, the more God will expect of you. God is fair. God doesn't judge you for what you didn't know, but he will judge us for what we did know and what we did with it. It's in lots of places in the Bible. I'll show you one. Jesus, as he's been teaching and preaching and doing miracles in Galilee, the Lord Jesus says this. Then Jesus, Matthew 11, verse 20. Then Jesus began to denounce the towns in which most of his miracles had been performed because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! Little villages around Galilee. For if the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. He goes on to say, these guys heard him preach, they saw all the miracles, and they still wouldn't believe or turn to God. He's saying that it'll be worse for you than the big pagan cities down the road because they didn't get all that info. So there's that theme. You may want to ask or comment on that in just a moment. Now, what else? Well, the Bible leads us to see Belshazzar and co drink the wine and mock the God of Israel and praise the idols. The New Testament tells us if you're a follower of Jesus, to expect that you'll be mocked. Okay? Expect that. So, for example, in 2 Peter, Peter says, above all, you must understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They'll say, where is this coming, he promised? Ever since our ancestors died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation. Okay? If you're a follower of Jesus, you know you'll be mocked, etc. Sometimes it's kind of in fun, PJ O'Rourke style. For others, it's an absolute kind of almost obsession to want to mock or put down the idea of God. How are those who follow Jesus to respond? They are not to respond in kind. So, for example, and this is not easy, 1 Peter 2 says this, 1 Peter 2:21. For this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. So as Jesus being crucified, etc., they're mocking him. He didn't retaliate. In fact, how should you respond if you're a follower of Jesus? Peter says, 1 Peter 3:15, in your hearts revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this, what? With gentleness and respect. Not always easy, but that's what he's saying. Why? You want to win the person, not just the argument. Okay. But if I could say, you can't read chapter 5 without saying, God holds people accountable, and it is a desperately serious thing to mock the God who holds our life in his hands. So the Apostle Paul warns in Galatians chapter 6, verse 7, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Or Hebrews warns us, it is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. The warnings are there, loud and clear. But I just wanted to finish with one story that I found. I started with the clip of Christopher Hitchens, and he was outspoken in his criticism of Christianity, of the way God presents in the Bible, etc. It's very sad that in 2010, when he was about to go on a book tour of his biography, Hitch 22, he was diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus and had to cancel the tour. And December 2011, he died at the age of 62. Very sad. And I mean that. I was very sad to read that had happened. But I found this book, an article, The Faith of Christopher Hitchens, A Restless Soul, The World's Most Notorious Atheist. Christopher Hitchens was shaky in his atheism, as the new book suggests. This man, Larry Taunton, had written this book called The Faith of Christopher Hitchens. Let me read you a little bit about the article. Now, what I'm about to say, too, may not be what you expect. It says, this came out in 2016. In his new book, The Faith of Christopher Hitchens, The Restless Soul of the World's Most Notorious Atheist, the evangelical writer Alex Taunton writes about his friendship with Mr. Hitchens, the witty and impious author of God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Mr. Hitchens died of esophageal cancer in 2011. Mr. Taunton describes intimate talks that occurred during long drives, like one 13 hours, one 7 hours, that took the two together. The two took together to various speaking events, which left him wondering if a dying Mr. Hitchens was edging towards belief in God. Unsurprisingly, evangelicals have celebrated the book, while some of Mr. Hitchens' secular friends have winced. As Mr. Taunton drove, Mr. Hitchens read aloud from the Gospel of John and mulled over the precise reason Jesus wept at the death of Lazarus. To quote, "Where is grace in the Old Testament?" Hitchens asked at one point in Mr. Taunton's telling. "I see it in the New Testament, but God is different in the Old Testament." Based on these conversations, Mr. Taunton concluded that Mr. Hitchens was seeking and that he was at least open to the possibility that Christianity was true. Steve Wasserman, a literary agent, an editor and executor of Mr. Hitchens' estate, described the book as a shabby business with unverifiable conversations are made to contradict everything Christopher Hitchens ever said or stood for. Mr. Taunton admitted, contemplating conversion and being close to Christ are two very different things. Now, I read that, I don't know what Christopher Hitchens was thinking as he knew that he was going to die. No idea. And even if this man is telling the exact truth, he doesn't really know. But I'll tell you something that's interesting, or that is amazing. If Christopher Hitchens did actually turn to God and ask for forgiveness and trust that Jesus died so he can be forgiven and have the promise of eternal life, God would meet him more than halfway. Like the prodigal son who comes back and the father runs to him and embraces him to welcome him home, God would even do that for this man. And so I couldn't help but think as I finished, that is, the Bible presents us with this stark choice of how dangerous it is to fall into the hands of the living God or to come back and be embraced by his arms. Chapter 5, lots to think about.
Can we believe this stuff?
Yeah, I can't show you any particular historical record that that happened. Okay. What you can show is that the writer, and Joyce Baldwin's commentary that we talked about last week is good, that the writer understood the way the Babylon worked, that the language fits that particular time, etc., that there was that they were aware of the history of how the Persians took the city in that one night, etc. But that particular one, I think you look at where you can see the Bible or the Old Testament touch archaeology, where you can see that the New Testament is historical, and that I think the package holds water, if you like. Okay? So that's what I think. Yep. That's a fair question, you know. And say, so, the furnace in chapter 3. Well, you think, well, wait a minute. Is there a creator who could do that? That's the... And then it's the big picture. What we do know is that Jesus took the book of Daniel very seriously. Chapter 7, next week, Jesus uses a title out of there as the main way that as his name tag. So Jesus believed the book of Daniel.
We've got time for another question or two, or comment. I've got one out. Looking at this part of Daniel, assuming that it did actually happen, should followers of Jesus just be kind of ready in case Numbered Way Divided appears on the boardroom wall at the Christmas party? Like, what should
if it did, you should probably take it seriously.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
God, it's how do you expect God to communicate with us?
Yeah.
Okay. The book of Hebrews says, in the past, God spoke to our fathers in many and various ways, etc. But now that God has spoken to us in the person of Jesus and in the historical writings and so on of the apostles, the Bible says that is enough and generally all we need to expect. Okay. Now, God may do the extraordinary, but he hasn't promised to. So, if there's writing on the wall at the Christmas party, yeah, I'd have a really hard look at it.
Yeah.
But I'm not expecting that to happen, and it's not really needed.
Okay.
I guess that's the... Okay.
So if I was chatting with a friend or colleague and they said, well, look, if God really had an important message for me, like, your number's up...
Yes.
He'd give me some sort of sign like he did for Nabonidus. What could you say?
I was once at a question and answer meeting and there was a man there who was would have described himself as a hardcore atheist. And we sat in the room and he said, okay, if God's there, why not make it clear and like write something on the moon or whatever? And I did point out that he had a book in his hand in a language that he could read, okay, with a simple story about God and forgiveness and a baldy-headed bloke doing his best to explain it to him, okay, which is probably easier and clearer in his own lap. He actually had it in his hand at the time. And he's saying, well, how come God doesn't give me a message on the moon? We probably can't write a lot on the moon anyway, but And I just thought, well, yeah, you're actually refusing to look at the very place that's literally in your hand and saying, I want it somewhere else. So I think there's a, how could I put it? I would humbly suggest he's not completely genuine in searching for God, God's message in that.
Okay.
Would that be, yeah?
Yeah.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.